Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, hello. A very warm welcome into RNIB Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host, Dave Williams. It's good to have your company. Welcome in. This time on Tech Talk, we will be taking a look back at the year in review, 2023. We'll be sharing some of our highlights throughout the year, and we'll be having a bit of a chat here as well about some of the things that we have found particularly interesting and exciting. We're always keen to hear from you here at Tech Talk, so do get in touch, do drop us a line. It's the usual email address, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Voice notes, emails, all that stuff, very, very welcome. Coming up this week, we'll be hearing about the world of online dating if you are blind or partially sighted. We'll be hearing about some of the new technologies that were trialled in 2023, and we'll be looking forward to the future of accessible technology. Welcome in, gentlemen, our co-hosts, Callum Stoneman and Hubert Pavalkovich. Good to have you with us. It's been a fascinating year.
It has.
It's been quite something.
Yeah. Yeah. Dominated, of course, the elephant in the room is AI. Let's talk about our technology highlights of the year, and we'll start right there. We're all using AI. We're all excited about it. What do you think's been the biggest, most useful, the most impactful application of AI? Callum Stoneman.
Well, I mean, it's in terms of impactful, it's got to be the image descriptions from Be My AI and other similar services. I think Be My AI is the main one. Bing Chat now supports images, and that does a similar thing. I used that when I was desperately trying to get on the beta list for Be My AI. That was my sort of in between. I think the biggest use for me, though, has been that Bing Chat, you know, the ChatGPT, but powered by Bing, and it's got the ability to look up the, you know, to look things up on the internet, as opposed to having that 2021 cutoff time. And I've been using that. Obviously, you've got to double check your sources and double check where it's getting its information from. But I've been using that instead of Google, you know, rather than Googling something and scrolling through a whole long list of results, just ask it a question. And chances are you'll get an answer. You know, you'll get the right answer as well.
And of course, Google, you know, have responded with Google Bard. So all the big players dabbling with AI in some shape, way or form. And so far, touch wood, a lot of this stuff is pretty screen reader accessible, which is particularly exciting. Hubert, how is AI impacting you?
I mean, yes, I have used ChatGPT as well as a few other features. But for me with AI, it has to be the AI narration and services such as 11 Labs that I've used, where you can put in some text and you can have it read to you by what sounds like a very much natural human voice, which has been quite a discovery for me to help make content more accessible for people to listen to and more nicer experience to listen to.
Yeah, I think the big thing for me has been the images on social media. You know, that social media, of course, is awash with images, and a very, very small percentage of images that are posted to social media will ever receive a description, as much as we all sort of campaign for and advocate for content creators to make their content accessible. You know, the reality is that, you know, most don't and won't, you know, however easy you make it for them. So actually, having AI in our toolbox gives us a way of accessing that information. You know, when somebody posts like an infographic or, you know, some other image with very little text description, then I think, you know, AI kind of comes to the rescue in some cases.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, how many images and, you know, memes and stuff have we missed out on over the years? And now just been able to, because the fact that you don't even have to, on most platforms, you don't even have to save the image to your phone and then go in and share it that way. You can just share it from, I mean, like X, for example, you can just bring up the share sheet directly and just go, describe with Be My Eyes, and then 10 seconds later, you've got a description.
other trends this year. Well, we haven't heard as much about the metaverse as we were expecting. You know, this is the idea that you can experience the online world in a more immersive way, whether that's through, you know, a headset. I guess the Vision Pro was the, you know, the sort of the announcement that people are kind of talking about in the background. It's not quite here yet. Maybe we'll hear more about that next year. Blockchain, a decentralized way of storing secure information, that's still rumbling along in the background, making headlines. 3D printing, which of course has been around for a little while. I know that the project to build a new Moorfields Eye Hospital in London have been making use of 3D printing technology to offer the consultants on the project, you know, a physical model of what the new building will be shaped like. And of course, those robots are never far away. We heard about the Starship delivery robots that may be bringing our groceries any day now. So lots of exciting technology trends in 2023. We've got some of our highlights from the year for you to enjoy. So kick back. It's another Tech Talk. Global Accessibility Awareness Day comes round each May, and this year we had the privilege of speaking with Jenny Leigh Flurry and Hector Minto from Microsoft. Given Microsoft's huge portfolio of products and services that Microsoft delivers to the world, how do you make accessibility consistent across such a wide portfolio?
Oh, goodness. Well, we don't sleep is the first. But, you know, candidly, it is a responsibility that we take incredibly seriously. We are far from perfect, but we have a really, really high bar and expectation for everything that comes out of Microsoft. And I will say the same bar exists internally as well. And it's a constant moving ecosystem. You know, I've had the privilege of being in this role as CAO now for 7.5 years. And every year I see it maturing and taking another click forward, which is positive progress always, but there's always far more to do. But bluntly, it takes time, it takes energy, and it takes consistent reinforcement. Every Microsoft employee takes mandatory training on accessibility. That same training is what Hector mentioned in terms of being available to Department of Work and Pensions and some of the amazing staff in Liverpool. But we take this really, really seriously. And ever you don't have what you need, I urge you to give us a call. We really, really want that feedback.
We know that you've worked really hard to make sure that Microsoft products are accessible out of the box. I've recently been using Narrator a bit more as a backup. But when it comes to your digital stores and those third parties who develop using Microsoft tools and platforms, what expectations do you have of them when it comes to accessibility?
Well, I love that you're using Narrator. That was one area. Windows, I think, is always going to be such a core and key platform for us. We're deeply committed, and that amazing team. Because clearly, let's be blunt, this is not all me or Hector. There is an amazing array of people across the company that lead accessibility and work on it and take your feedback and prioritize what we're doing next. So Narrator's actually been one heck of a journey. Still more to do, same with magnification and high contrast. And I think it's one great example of what we do going forward is to take that feedback in and then prioritize the roadmap as we go forward. But there was a second part to your question. Remind me, what was that?
Well, it's really about your expectations of those third-party developers who are using your tools, yeah.
You know, my ideal world, I think our idea, every role, every job has accessibility as a part of it. And that's what we fundamentally believe. And we see a lot of success when we work with not just third parties, but also first parties internally, the developer segment, which is so big at Microsoft and so rich. When we have disabled talent and we're empowering that talent, we just my goodness. So some of the work that's happened in Visual Studio as one example of that, they've actually just launched Accessibility Checker into Visual Studio, which is one of the major development platforms. I think from a third-party perspective, again, Microsoft believes in not just the inbox, what comes in Windows, but building an ecosystem that anyone can design and build on. That sets us a little unique in some ways, but it also means that our partnership with third parties is very important, whether that's Vispero or NVDA or any of the amazing companies that are building technologies that can sit on top of a Windows platform or using our code base. So it's a core requirement for us, and not just developers, but also, bluntly, I'll add in suppliers. Mm. We work with 20,000 suppliers, and we have made it a core requirement that accessibility is a part of that contract. So I think it's one of those, I use the words ecosystem, and that doesn't work for everyone. So maybe there's a better word, Hector, you can tell me. I've been living in the States a long time.
I think what you're talking about is the confidence we're trying to build in the tech sector to build more accessible technologies. Yes. And to understand the benefit of doing it. You know, so there's this relationship between the buyer and the seller of technologies, whether that's in the consumer space, but you know, I would argue more specifically in the government and the enterprise space. I think a lot of the work that we've been doing over the last number of years has raised awareness of what accessibility really is and what it means to make something functionally accessible, as opposed to just tell people that it is accessible. And I think our role is to help the tech sector more widely feel more confident to have this conversation with customers about the journey they're on accessibility, and we have definitely seen that.
And I hope, bluntly, in the next few months, we see a overwhelming interest in designing and building in our world.
Microsoft has a very busy disability answer desk. I believe you take around 13,000 calls a month. Sometimes, though, I find pockets of the community that just don't know it's there. How do we improve awareness and address that?
So, Disability Answer Desk, we lovingly call it DAD, is our support team for disabled customers and employees. Actually, it has an internal side to it. It started a decade ago, in fact, almost 11 years ago. And I started it with a premise that good technical support wasn't available for disabled people from Microsoft. And we should fix that gap. And bluntly, spin forward, we've taken 1.5 million calls and counting. We take on average 12 to 13,000 calls a month. And it's from customers all over the world, many of whom are new. They're newly disabled, they've acquired a disability. Good reminder that this is the one cool community that you can join at any point in your life, and they want to know what technology is available, or they have a situation, or they have a problem, or forbid they have seen an error, and they want to know how to fix that. And yes, it's a free service, anyone can call. And we're innovating with this service all the time. Our partnership between DAD and Be My Eyes that we just announced today on GAD is a good example of that, where you can now use Be My Eyes and GPT in addition to DAD. So you can take a picture of your service, get it described by GPT, and you may be able to solve it yourself before you need to talk to a human. But it's there for you to help you to accelerate your journey with the technology in your hands.
Earlier this year in June, I took a trip to Stevenage Station to see how AIRA, the visual interpreting service, can make travel more accessible for blind and partially sighted passengers looking to navigate a train station. While there, I've spoken to Bedfordshire Sight Loss Council volunteer Paul Day, who has been trialling the technology. What is your usual experience when travelling on trains? Do you find any challenges? Is it generally positive? What would you say?
Mostly positive, yeah. I mean, I travel a couple of times a week since I retired, left work last year. So most of my journeys are for leisure or for voluntary sort of activities. But I find, on the whole, it's very, very good. I think that's thanks to the staff at the stations that I'm travelling to and from, the accessibility of the trains, the announcements on board. So generally, I would describe myself as a very, say, confident and happy traveller, really.
How did you find using it? What was your experience like?
Well, I've never used a live assistance app before, and I thought this was a really imaginative way of putting one to good use. We've been trialling it at Stevenage. That's a station I know very well. Been using it for best part of 40 years. So you can imagine there's not a lot I don't know about it. But notwithstanding, I did find it quite a useful exercise this morning. Pinpointing something I was particularly looking for. An example would be the lift buttons. I never use the lift. So being guided towards that, I thought was quite a very useful thing, and also guiding me through what was a very, very busy station. So getting from the entrance to the ticket gates would have been a bit of a battle on my own. I would have done it, but with the assistance app in operation and someone, you know, verbally guiding me through the camera in the phone, that was pretty successful. My only sort of reservation, I suppose, was I don't use headphones on my iPhone. So I was struggling a little bit to hear what was being said. And when we first connected on one of the calls, I wasn't quite sure if they'd heard me or whether they were live. And I did get cut off on one of them as well. So I had to redial, but that was easy enough. The other reservation I have, perhaps a little bit, is holding a phone and navigating with a cane at the same time. Left me no spare hands, of course. So that was bit of a challenge. So I wouldn't want to be doing it for too long, but then the way I see using the app is it's just going to be a quick, short, sharp solution to, you know, finding something quite quickly, even if it's just a member of staff or just navigating through a busy walkway. There isn't a lot of room at Stevenage Station, and it's a very crowded area, but I found it very good on the whole. It was quite a good, enlightening experience for me.
How easy did you find you navigating the app itself? How easy was the app to use to get the call going and, you know, hang up the call? How easy did you find it for someone who's not used the app before?
Relatively easy, actually. I mean, I had a look at it before I came out, and, you know, there was a call assistance button quite near the top. I think when I first opened the app, it jumped me to the bottom of the screen, so I just put my finger on the top of the screen and found the button quite easily. Just double tapping on that, it only took a few seconds for the operator to answer. There was a little tone as well, so you knew something was happening. And ending a call was quite easy as well. It wasn't an overcomplicated screen, but I think having a little look at it in advance helps. I knew what I was up against. And I would also say registering for it was nice and easy as well.
How does the IRA app compare to other technology and solutions you've used before?
In terms of what I use already, so the National Rail app would be the main means of, you know, knowing where my trains are and what platforms they're going from, etc., etc. I think it complemented things pretty well.
What sort of feedback and recommendations would you provide to either the rail companies or the app IRA app developers?
Well, I think we're right at the beginning of the trial, so today it felt like day one, so they're doing this for a year. So I guess they'll learn as they go along. I think my feedback would be that it's just available at four stations, albeit four of the busiest stations on the Thameslink network. So if you're travelling to and from those stations, you could potentially make a journey without disturbing a member of staff, depending on how knowledgeable and you are on the environment. So I would be quite happy, for example, travelling from Stevenage to East Croydon and using the IRA app at both ends of the journey just to navigate my way onto the platform, or more importantly at East Croydon perhaps, which is less familiar, but I know what I'm looking for. But it's just having those pair of eyes in your phone to help you either get to the footbridge or the main exit would be really useful.
And how important do you think it is for, you know, transport companies to introduce these sorts of technologies to help passengers?
Well, I think it's quite imaginative of them, and I think, you know, I'm really glad GTR have decided to go with this, because it's something I wouldn't have thought of. And to be honest, when I first looked at it, I thought, well, how's this really going to help me? But I think I've seen this morning that as I've said, there's potential for it to be really useful. So, and I think what I hope it might do as well is encourage people who are a little bit anxious about coming back to rail travel. Maybe they've lost their sight or lost a lot of sight and feel a bit daunted by travelling. I hope, you know, having access to someone when you're a bit stuck and on your own and you can't find a member of staff, or you're not sure where you are or how to get in or how to get out of somewhere, then I think that's quite an assuring factor, and I'd hope that would swing it for people.
Based on the testing you've done, how do you think it will change your future experiences of train travel?
Well, I think that's time will tell, won't it? I mean, I go through Stevenage at least once a month, so I think I'll be more inclined to give it a little spin every so often to see how it works. If I want to use the lift, for example, if it's really busy around the gate line, perhaps going down the lift, I'll just give them a call and just make sure they direct me to the gate, because to me it isn't obvious where the lifts are. They used to be goods lifts at Stevenage and they've been converted for passenger use, so they're not in an obvious place like most lifts are at railway stations, so they're away from the ticket gates. So trying to find them, and there's a retail outlet between the two of them as well, so there's people coming in and out of that all the time, and you're on a main thoroughfare across Stevenage station as well, so it's a bit of a bun fight trying to get across there sometimes without getting your cane tangled up with people. So having the option of just getting to a lift quickly, avoiding the worst going through the ticket gates, would be, I think it's the way I would probably look at it. And maybe also once I'm waiting on the platform, staff do come along and ask you if you need any help, and you say, no, I'm okay, thank you. And then I change my mind and I think, well, I'd quite like to go into the waiting room now, it's getting a bit cold. So I could call up somebody to just tell me exactly where the door to the waiting room is, because I roughly know where it is, but getting to the door, you know, could be a bit haphazard, but at least I know I've got that option of calling somebody just very quickly and guiding me to it, or telling me where I'm there when I've actually arrived there.
Fantastic. Well, Paul Day, Bedfordshire Sight Loss Council volunteer, thank you very much for joining us here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you very much, Hubert.
Of course, it is that time of year when we are looking back at some of the technology trends. But what about our individual experiences? What technology purchases or discoveries have really made a difference this year? Hubert, you got yourself a new piece of hardware this year that is making a big difference for you.
Yes, for me, I think it has to be the Hable One, which we've talked about on Tech Talk and we've even done a demo of. It's the Braille keyboard, which to me has made things so much more easy and so much more convenient. And I've had to put it on charge for the first time in 8 months of use, so it is fantastic.
I imagine that kind of battery life. That's really good. So when you say it's making things easier, just sort of explain that if you would then. How is it making things easier for you?
I mean, it's the ability, because I can type in Braille quite quickly, despite not being able to read Braille all that well. And the good thing is I've got a keyboard that I can type very quickly with, which doesn't take up a lot of space. I can literally put it in my pocket and just take it out on the train, for example, quickly type something when my phone's out of reach and I'm wearing headphones. You know, it's things like that, or be able to control my phone when it's further away. It's just these sorts of convenience things. And also having a keyboard, which, like I said, is small enough that you don't need a bag for it.
And why would you go for that, Hubert, rather than just a regular Bluetooth keyboard? Because you can pick up a Bluetooth keyboard for like 20, 30 quid, can't you? You know, so the Hable One, it's I think it's a couple of £100. So it is quite an investment. Excellent battery life, as you've said, Braille keyboard. But why have you gone down that road particularly rather than a regular Bluetooth keyboard?
I think one obviously is the above mentioned small size of it, which makes it more portable. The other one is if you type in Braille and you like the typing in Braille, you like to type in Braille, I think, and you can do it quite quickly, I quite like the experience. Plus I also like the experience that it's not only a keyboard, but it also allows you to control your phone and control other functions on it without having to reach for your phone, when sometimes that may not be easy to do. You know, that's what I quite like as well. It's the portability and the Braille typing, which I've missed, I have to say, because I always typed in on a QWERTY keyboard. But when I've kind of gotten this one and retrained myself how to type in Braille using like the standard 6-dot combinations, I quite missed it.
Callum, you've been excited by developments in navigation technology this year. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, so obviously I purchased the WeWalk smart cane kind of halfway through this year. And it's a bit of ups and downs, really, because I wasn't going to buy it. I bought it after the loss of my guide dog, so obviously quite sad circumstances in which I ended up purchasing it. But it's been pretty good. It's not quite matched what I thought it was going to be, you know, in a smart cane, but it's been good. It's been an interesting thing to try out. I think it's got a lot of potential. The big thing for me, though, has been not so much a purchase, but a discovery, has been the Voice Vista navigation app, which is one that's come off the back of Soundscape. So they've taken Soundscape's code. This developer has taken the open source Soundscape code from Microsoft and really just completely, I don't want to say revamped the code, because that's probably not the case, but revamped the app. It's got a completely different interface now, which I think is a lot nicer. It's got the traditional Soundscape features of all the beacons and the positional audio, but then he's added things like turn-by-turn directions, better support for work using it alongside third-party navigation apps, more flexibility with how you set your beacons and how you hear your beacons. This developer is adding features to this app, seems like on a daily basis. And it's been great to see, you know, it's been great to see. I've still got the other Soundscapes installed as well, you know, the Scottish Tech Army one and the one from, I think it's CNIB, because I just want to see the development and see where they go. But Voice Vista for me is my favourite at the minute.
And there's a few to choose from, as you say. I think for me, the highlight has been, you know, meeting other blind and partially sighted people who have recommended technology. You know, I've been lucky to go to a couple of conferences this year. I was at CSUN, at NFB, and when I was at NFB, I was hanging out with some guys from the Berklee School of Music, and they were telling me about iReal Pro, an app that I was aware of but had never used. And this is for musicians who want to practice, and so there are lots of, you know, popular songs on there, jazz, blues, all sorts of different genres. And then you search for a tune that you're interested in, and then you get a backing track, and you can tell it what key and tempo you want that backing track to be in, and which instruments you want to be included and the style. But the really amazing thing from my point of view is that it actually tells you the chords. They read with voiceover, which often, you know, it can be difficult to access that information in a mainstream app. There are specialist services where you can get music scores. You know, I'm not really a big music reader, but, you know, quite helpful to know as somebody who plays in a blues band, okay, what are the chord changes in this one? You know, sometimes you can hear them, sometimes you need a little bit of help. So iReal Pro, it wasn't a free app. I had to buy it, but I don't think it was very much. I think it was like a tenner or something, and I found that to be incredibly accessible. So that's not a new thing either. You know, it's just something that it was only just by being around other blind and partially sighted people who were talking about it that they made me aware that that app was accessible. And I think that's the important thing. And that's the value, hopefully, of Tech Talk. It's our opportunity to share with each other. You know, often manufacturers and suppliers, they can claim accessibility, but what's it really like? You only really know, I think, when you speak with other blind and partially sighted people. So let us know, what's been your purchase or discovery this year that's made a big difference to you? We'd love to hear about it. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Hubert, Callum, thanks a lot. Way back in February, we were thinking about how a blind or partially sighted person might be looking for love online. And I spoke with Siobhan Mead, who is a social media influencer and somebody who's tried online dating.
For me, I think as a blind person, going into clubs and bars can be a bit of a challenge. You know, the whole blindness thing, you can't see if anyone's looking at you. You don't want to go up to someone who's potentially already in a relationship. And online dating just seemed the easiest option for me. It's very quick. You can look at different profiles. And I just thought, why not? I've never done it before, never had the opportunity, never needed to. And what with, I suppose, COVID still very much around, I wanted to kind of do something a little bit easier for myself.
And had you used any online dating apps or services previously?
No, never. So I wanted to kind of like look at the biggest one. And the biggest one that I went to, the first one, it was Tinder, because a lot of people said, oh, yeah, go on Tinder. It'll be great. It'll be fine. And I never needed to kind of look elsewhere.
Right. Okay. So just talk a bit about setting up your profile then. What was that like? What did you have to do? Were there any particular issues for you as a blind person?
In terms of setting up the Tinder profile, I got to the point mostly where I could say live and go. But as you probably be aware, there are so many different accessibility issues that I came across. So it wasn't plain sailing. I couldn't add or select photos because the buttons weren't labeled. And when I tried to, it just wouldn't allow me to upload. So that was the biggest kind of barrier, because you couldn't then kind of continue adding or finishing off your profile. And there were certain things that I couldn't edit or enter into to text boxes. So I had to get a trusty friend to kind of do that for me. And again, you don't necessarily always want someone, you know, to look at those sorts of things. It's quite a personal thing to kind of have to go through. But I have some good friends and they managed to do it for me.
Yeah, sometimes, unfortunately, we do have to lean on our friends. But you're absolutely right. It's, you know, it's an empowerment thing. It's an independence thing. It's something that we want to do ourselves. So, OK, so you got a friend to help you get the right images uploaded, and you were able to presumably write your bio and that sort of stuff. So how about making connections then? So once your profile's live, what happens next?
So once you're live, you can go through the app and you can look at potential matches. Now, it doesn't really give you a lot of descriptions. Now, for me, as someone who is totally blind and rely on VoiceOver, the screen reading software, it didn't actually give me a lot of information on people's profile. It came up with the name, their age, and the location they lived, but that's about it. Then when I tried to tap into their profile, it was very hit and miss. That the voiceover would lose focus, the app would sometimes close you out, and then, you know, you have to start again. So a lot of it was, I think, very, very visual. Hence the reason I kind of had to get my friends sometimes to kind of say yes, no, swipe left if you don't, swipe right if you do. So I ended up finding myself just swiping right just because I had no other option. And it wasn't just like an ego thing. Hey, I've got 100 matches. It really is just the fact that I had no other way of knowing.
I mean, you mentioned there that one of the accessibility issues when you were setting up the profile was unlabeled buttons. And obviously, Tinder works by kind of auditioning images, essentially. So not on the face of it, particularly blind friendly. Did you feed back to Tinder at all about some of the accessibility issues that you encountered?
I did actually send an email to say, look, this would be really useful as someone who is now using this platform. It would be really helpful if the buttons could be labeled or if accessibility could be looked at, because I'm essentially a customer, really. If I want to kind of like boost, or if I want to pay for a subscription, then, you know, I'm essentially a customer that's going to be bringing in the money. But until the buttons are labeled and I feel like I'm getting a service, I wasn't going to pay for anything. But I did actually feedback, because I think it's important to let them know where the areas are that they could improve. And I think it's such an easy thing for any designer looking at digital accessibility to do when you first implement an app. Look at that, because, you know, you're essentially excluding a large proportion of society if you're not making it universally designed in the planning stages.
Absolutely. It's always easier to build in accessibility from the start than try and retrofit it later. Did you make any connections?
I did. I actually did. I got chatting to several people, and it was going like really well. until they found out I was blind, which kind of was a massive dent, because there was a couple that were potentials, and I did feel that, you know, we could meet. But I think it was the whole sense that their attitude was, well, if you're blind, I don't want to be a carer. Well, you know, that's, I think that's just a little bit presumptuous to suggest that because I'm blind that I'm going to need a carer, not a potential partner. You know, I stayed on there for about 3 months and decided that, well, it just wasn't for me in the end, and came away from it.
Do you think that's possibly a reason for maybe disclosing earlier? Obviously, you chose not to disclose in your bio or whatever. You wanted to be evaluated on other things, and maybe people would be more reluctant to contact a blind person. But then I guess the flip side to that is that if you disclose earlier, then you're sort of saying take it or leave it, right?
Yeah, for me, I'm personally, I felt that it was important, you know, not to mention, because I didn't want my blindness to be defined in that way. However, I did have great big adoring guide dog Marty in my photos, because I thought, well, you know, that's a part of my life. And I didn't say that I was blind, but it kind of was insinuating, you know, through the pictures that I was. But I think it depends on each person if they want to kind of open that can and say that they are. Some people do, some people don't. I just feel that take me as I am, blindness or not.
And have you spoken with other blind and partially sighted people about their experiences with dating apps? Do those experiences tally with your own?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've spoken to quite a handful of people just about my own experience and how I found it, how they find it. Are they still looking? Do they disclose whether they're blind or not? Have they had any conversations and awkwardness around it? And the consensus is a lot of people do experience the same things I do, whether it's discrimination, whether it's someone saying, well, you know, blindness isn't for me, and without even knowing the person. So yeah, I think it's, you know, it's widely known that unfortunately these experiences aren't unique just to me.
So given all those challenges and limitations, some of which we've talked about in this conversation, do you think overall dating apps and online dating services, do you think they're a good option for blind people?
I do think they're a good option, because at the end of the day, you can sit at the comfort of your own home, you can speak to people, you can gauge what they're like through the conversations that you have. And I think it's a lot easier to build up those rapport and relationships rather than trying to go out into bars, clubs, nightclubs, and any other kind of social gathering that you go to, because it is a lot harder, admittedly. So yeah, I do think it's a good option. And I think if anyone is in the dating scene, it's the month of love, you know, give it a try. Let me know how you get on.
One of the big RNIB events that I had the pleasure of attending this year was the Inclusive Design for Sustainability Conference in Glasgow. And having purchased one of their smart canes earlier on in the year, I was really keen to have a chat with the team behind WeWalk. What's your experience been like? Have you enjoyed it being here with us?
Well, I'm worried I might be slightly biased when I say it's been fantastic, given that we work with the RNIB, of course, but truthfully, it really has. For the simple reason that we've been, you know, it's one of those conferences that actually brings everyone together. I mean, our everyday users, to decision makers, to people behind policy, to even developers. And that's really refreshing because, you know, very few conferences in the world get that breadth of opinion and breadth of people in one single place. So not only, obviously, meeting you, Callum, and meeting our WeWalk users, but also being able to speak to developers, bounce ideas off each other, and also to potential policymakers and decision makers to make sure that more people can get access to our product. I mean, what more can you ask for, right? And of course, it's only the RNIB that could deliver something like this. So it's been great.
Now, we've just been having a kind of panel discussion about the kind of future of navigation apps and things like that. And something that you kind of just slipped in there at the last minute is a kind of a soft launch of a new service that you guys have been working on called WeAssist. So do you want to just tell us a bit about that and, you know, what it is and what we can expect.
Of course. Well, I'm glad the just one more thing moment actually worked. It's gotten some people's attention, which is great.
It worked really well.
The idea behind WeAssist is actually quite simple, as is WeWalk. WeWalk works in most environments. I mean, it works outdoors, but we realize that it's not going to be able to read text just yet or navigate you in every indoor space just yet. And sometimes, you know, the agent, the human, is always going to be your fallback mechanism. And that's exactly behind the idea behind WeAssist, is that you can get someone dependable, someone that's professionally trained to work and guide a visually impaired user across these diverse environments through a multitude of tasks, be it navigation, reading labels, looking at a menu at a restaurant, finding an empty seat or table. And that's exactly what WeAssist is, you know. You've got your WeWalk out, you suddenly need a little bit of extra help, well then WeAssist is here for you. And that's really our unique selling point, if you'd like, in this instance. In the sense that whilst we love our volunteers and we love people that support us, we also realize that there are certain instances where you're going to want a trained agent that's going to be there, that's going to guide you for those very, very specific tasks. And that's what we offer. So each of our volunteers, each of our agents are all vetted. They're all run through a training course. And we make sure that if you do need them in a bit of a pickle, they're going to be there for you. And that soft launch is actually very interesting. So we want to make sure we get the service right. We don't want to just launch and sort of find out that it's not working as it should. So the idea behind the soft launch is will be available between 12 to 3 p.m. from the 1st of July, free of charge. So UK is currently a free zone, essentially, where people can test it out, they can try it out, they can get a feeling for the service, let us know how it could be improved, what's going well, what's not going so well. Of course, with the RNIB being a key supporter of this, and hopefully growing from there together.
So you said it's available, you know, this is a soft launch and it's, you know, available from 12 to 3 p.m. Is that every day so far?
Apart from Sundays.
Okay.
So weekdays only.
Yeah. And is this kind of a, do you think it's fair to describe this as a bit of a beta stage of it then, just for people to test it out, as you said, get a bit of a feel for it, give feedback on it?
I would say so, yep. It helps not just our users, we'd want, but also it helps us to understand how we can tailor our services. And this is actually a bit of a plug and a bit of a transition, because we're working on an interesting computer vision project with Imperial College and the RNIB, again, as a project partner. And we take in the way that users use their cameras and sort of the things that they want a sighted agent to do, to try to build some computer vision models that might even be able to replicate that. So that's very, very exciting. It doesn't just help our users and help us deliver a better service, but it might also help our research and development to really create some pretty cool stuff in the future. So yeah, we definitely want to make sure we get this right for our community.
Yeah. Without wanting to kind of just spring the really tough questions on you, there are similar services that, you know, there's things like Be My Eyes and Aira that kind of do this sort of thing already in terms of, you know, visual assistance and connecting to a human. So what's kind of different with WeAssist?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's kind of like comparing a toolbox. You wouldn't simply pitch the screwdriver as being the best tool for everything. You'd want sort of a plethora of different tools. And for us, we've looked carefully at these other services. We realize that, for example, Be My Eyes, it's great because you can connect with literally anyone you'd like. Whereas for us, we realized, okay, we want to fill a slightly different niche in the market, which is, you know, being able to, whilst also using WeWalk's complete multimodal navigation system, which is something very unique to WeWalk, have an agent be able to use that data to better support the user, trained agent, of course. So for instance, with our app, the agent can actually find out the user's exact location. Of course, this is all with the user's consent. They can then guide them on certain public transport or walking directions, again, using our built-in navigation system, which is unique to WeWalk. And this is all in that one seamless experience. So one of the issues I've had as a visually impaired person is jumping between 4 or 5 different apps to essentially conduct one task.
Yep.
With something like this, you've got that WeAssist service, you've got a trained agent, you've got your navigation and multimodal experience, all in a single place, all in one app. And that's really the preposition here, you know, being another tool in the toolkit for the person that prefers having that all-in-one experience.
In 2023, RNIB Connect Radio celebrated 20 years of broadcasting. As part of the celebrations, we took a look back at some of the great highlights in accessible technology over the last 20 years. This included gaming, and I had a chat with 2 blind and partially sighted gamers to talk about their memories of accessible gaming.
Hi,
what I want to ask you both is about a key development in gaming accessibility that you have seen over the last 20 years, and you know, why is it so important to you? So, Matthew, have you got one for us?
So I've been doing accessibility in video games for a number of years now. I think it's nearly 5 or 6 years I've been doing it. And the real shift for me was when The Last of Us 2 was released. I noticed massively in what I did part-time as an accessibility like advocate and consultant, that when that game was released, video games companies listened and was like, oh my God, this game's going to be accessible to all, because there was totally blind players playing it. There was deaf players playing it. There was amputees playing it. There wasn't anyone excluded from playing it. It was a game for all and a game for everyone. It was incredible. And I feel like that has now set the gold standard. It's shifted the whole industry for me. You saw an industry-wide shift of, oh my God, we can make games accessible for everyone. It's been done, and now we've got a target to set. Like, the target's been set, the bar's been set. And I think now games companies are starting to try and meet that target and meet the bar.
Kim, how about yourself?
I think something that stood out to me across games is dark mode. So I remember, like, you know, 20 years ago, everything was like glaring white with like black text on it. It used to give me headaches, and it was often the same in games, you know, not, you know, maybe good contrast, but a bit overwhelming. And then dark mode just became so popular. I don't even know when it happened, but, you know, suddenly games started to have, you know, options for UI. You know, they'd have like darker backgrounds naturally. You'd have like settings to adjust the brightness in game. And that just revolutionized it for me. You know, it was the difference between, you know, gaming for a few hours and having a horrible migraine the next day, or playing all day long and being okay. So even though it seems minor, dark mode has definitely like revolutionized my gaming.
It's whatever kind of whatever works for each person. And there are so many different accessibility tweaks that can sometimes make a world of difference to someone, even if they might be small to somebody else. So that is brilliant. So now to preview our 2043 Tech Talk episode, where we look into the future, I want to ask both of you, what would be, what are your future hopes for gaming accessibility over the next 20 years? Matthew, we'll start with you.
That it's put at the forefront of gaming, as well as everything else. It's not about forgetting about disabled gamers, it's about remembering us first. So when a game's created, we're not waiting to hear about accessibility features, or when a console's announced, we're not waiting to hear about accessibility features. It comes with the launch details. It comes when the game's announced, oh, this game will have these accessibility settings, and just making sure it's inclusive for all, and video games are inclusive for all.
And Kim, what would it be for you?
I just want a world where everyone just assumes that blind and partially sighted people do play games, rather than the opposite. Especially with the kind of segregation that goes on now, it's really annoying. So, you know, there are people out there who assume, you know, if you have an eye condition, it's just audio games and nothing else. But I want to play what everyone else is playing. I want to play Fire Emblem. I want to play like the new Animal Crossing. So, yeah, I just really like that kind of changing attitude where everyone just sees it as normal to just play the same games as everyone else, regardless of what your sight level is.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much to both of you for reminiscing about gaming. Thank you very much, Kim, and thank you very much, Matthew Alcock, also known as the Wobbly Gamer.
As part of our 20th anniversary celebrations, we didn't just look back, we also looked forward. How might accessible technology develop over the next 20 years? I asked Robin Spinks, RNIB's inclusive design lead, author and futurist Ant Morse, and Stacey Scott from the world of accessible publishing about their hopes for the next two decades. Do you think accessibility and virtual reality will complement each other, or do you think there's some battles there?
No, I think they will, actually. And I think there's kind of, there's two different parts to it, and a third, which is an addition. So there's two specific technologies. Let's start with virtual reality. So that is about immersion into a space. And I think that will be used in therapy, especially solutions in the market that can enhance the experience. But I think really virtual reality will be niche. It will be very specialist in kind of health and therapy apps. Augmented reality is where the digital overlay of these, you know, millions of billions of things that are connected through the Internet of Things become accessible. Now, obviously, the augmented reality is usually a glass, or if we think to Apple's Vision Pro headset, it's about seeing those interactions. But it doesn't have to be. If we think to that voice assistant that I mentioned earlier, if you had a headset on that was looking out as well as projecting information to your peripheral vision, you could actually use that to say, what is in front of me? So it could give an audio description of an environment. And I know there's solutions that do this already, but it's not just that it would not only interact with its environment, but also the millions of things in the environment. So for example, regardless of it being sight loss or not, if you're walking down a street following some directions, it could interact with sensors locally, whether that's, let's say, a coffee shop. And it could then tell you there's a great offer at a coffee shop, and it knows what coffee you drink. And then it could offer you, you know, to the directions to that coffee shop's door. Interestingly, those voice assistants will do more. So it would say, would you like to place an order in advance? You're 200 meters away. So you could say, yeah, I'll have a flat white and whatever additions you want, a croissant or whatever that goes with it. And then it directs you directly to the door, and then you could interact with the environment because it's part of that application. So I think we'll see an interaction, and they call it the collisions of technology. So, you know, Internet of Things with augmented reality solutions complemented by voice assistants, I think will be a massive, massive opportunity. And the reason I stress it's going to be a massive opportunity is throughout my research, there's always one guiding factor. There's two, I guess. One is it useful? But two is, will it make any money? So if you follow the money, then it has an interest. So whether, regardless of who it's marketing to, if we're all walking down the street and we get suggested to a great coffee shop for a great cup of coffee, there's a fee for that. There's a, you know, it's almost like search, but in reverse. That there's a great offer that I may be interested in. So it could be a coffee shop, it could be a food outlet, it could be a store, but it's proactively coming to me. Now, there is a bit that people will say, oh, yeah, but what about the data protection? Well, that's something I'd be prepared to surrender. I'd be prepared to say, I like coffee. If somebody knows I like coffee, big deal. I'm not really that concerned. If somebody says, oh, well, they know your location, well, again, that might actually keep me safe as well as give me a great experience. So I'm not too precious about that. But obviously that has to be balanced. But yeah, I think this augmented reality with voice will open up a whole heap of possibilities for every user.
Yeah, we'll definitely dig into some of those ethical concerns in a moment. Robin Spinks, you lead RNIB's inclusive design efforts. What do you think virtual reality and augmented reality mean for accessibility?
I'm super excited about it. I mean, I think seeing, for example, the kind of device that Apple has developed in Apple Vision Pro, I'm really excited about that type of what they're calling spatial computing, what that might offer. And one of the obvious opportunities for me is, we all know in the sight loss sector that the orientation and mobility industry is in a state of chaos, and it's difficult to fill vacancies, it's difficult to recruit, people are not staying in the profession, so it's a really challenging place to be. I think there's a very obvious opportunity to harness this type of technology so that we can enable people who are newly diagnosed as visually impaired to have a mobility lesson with a person, but then to also introduce a VR type solution where you're able to learn about the depth of the steps that are in your local environment, the route from your house to the train station, what businesses are available en route, what facilities are there that you could also utilize. And you could almost practice the route from your house to the train station or to the library or to your work or wherever you're going from the comfort of your own living room. And then you could go out and do it in the real world. So it's that opportunity to blend a virtual experience with a real experience that ultimately will enable people to improve their confidence and develop their skills and increase their independence. So, you know, there's one example. I think there are many more like that. So I'm optimistic about it. I think the key consideration is that the tools develop with accessibility embedded. I've got a lot of confidence in, for example, Apple, and we know that they've made great efforts already to embed accessibility into Apple Vision Pro. Looking forward to trying that soon. But, you know, for all of the other guys in that space, they need to be serious about accessibility so that if you're a screen reader user or you require magnification or larger text, you've got all of that customization baked in. You know, that's a sort of design critical element that, you know, I would want to see across the board.
Stacey, having heard Ant and Robin, what are you thinking?
I mean, yeah, it certainly sounds like there's a lot of positive things ahead. For me, I guess I have this dream vision that, so one of my passions is tech, as you know, the other is travel, so all the T's basically. And so I just love to see this environment where, you know, I go somewhere abroad, and I've got, you know, some AI solutions, some wearables, and perhaps I'm using AR or VR to get an understanding of where I am. And so I don't have to either A, feel like I'm missing out on what I'm passing in a new environment, particularly when I'm traveling to experience a new city, or I don't have to rely on having a sighted person with me to literally say, oh, this market's selling X, this market's selling Y, this is a shop doing this, and they're out of breath and, you know, desperately trying to give me all the detail that I need. But actually, if I could have that in my ears, you know, through bone conducting headphones, and feel like actually that I'm traveling like anyone else would and could, that for me is the dream. And so I guess it's about AR and VR, but it's pulling all this technology together to enable people to go and live their dreams. And so that for me, that would be mine. Now, I don't know if that means I can ever just get on a speedboat and head out into the ocean on my own, but I definitely give it a go.
That is it for Tech Talk in 2023. We very much appreciate your company. Welcome all your comments and feedback. It is, of course, your show. Techtalk@rnib.org.uk is how you get in touch with us. Do tune in next time when we'll be having a panel discussion about what we can look forward to in accessible technology in the year 2024. Who would have thunk it? Well, there we are. Callum Stoneman, Hubert Pavalkovic, thank you, gentlemen, for all your hard work this year. Very much appreciate that.
No worries, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
Ah, it's been a pleasure.
Great stuff. And everyone else behind the scenes, we really appreciate you being there and keeping us on the straight and narrow. Well, until next year, from myself, Dave Williams, Callum Stoneman, and Hubert Pavalkovic, bye-bye.